Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This week on Witness History, we're bringing you five incredible stories from South Africa. You'll hear about the heartbreaking life of Sarah Bartman, an indigenous South African woman who was taken to Europe to perform in 19th century freak shows. Plus, how a South African singer called Brenda Fassie became known as the Madonna of the townships, and the school children who marched against apartheid. That's Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Friday the 26th of April, these are our main stories. The US Supreme Court judges appear sceptical of Donald Trump's claim that he should have immunity from prosecution for actions he took while president.
The Supreme Court's never been asked this question. They've never been asked it because no previous president has been accused of criminal behaviour like this.
President Macron of France warns of the huge challenges faced by Europe over its security.
We must be clear about the fact that Europe today is mortal. It could die. It is today that the questions of peace and war are being played out on our continent.
A transitional council is sworn in to lead Haiti and restore order after the Prime Minister resigns. Also in this podcast, New York's top court overturns one of the film mogul Harvey Weinstein's convictions for rape. And an opera in Arabic makes its debut in Saudi Arabia. The US Supreme Court has heard arguments on whether Donald Trump, as a former president, is immune from criminal prosecution over acts carried out while he was in the White House. The court's nine justices focused on actions Mr. Trump took to try and retain power after losing the 2020 election to Joe Biden. The former president is facing dozens of criminal charges in four cases, including an ongoing trial related to his business records, which is taking place in New York. We'll hear more on that trial shortly. But first, I asked our Washington correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue, what's been happening at the Supreme Court in the Capitol.
Really what is at the heart of this is the question, does a president have immunity from prosecution for their official acts? And that is what Donald Trump's lawyers are arguing. The special counsel who's been looking into those efforts to overturn the 2020 election argues that that is not the case. And they've been going back and forth on various constitutional provisions. Should impeachment and conviction precede criminal case? Should the president be immune from prosecution for everything or just for some of the things he does? So the nine justices now, Valerie, will go away and consider their opinion, and it could be a couple of months before we hear back from them.
And what could this mean for Donald Trump?
If he were to get his way and they were to agree with him that he has total immunity from criminal prosecution, that means that two of the other criminal cases against him would fall straight away. The Florida documents case, where he was accused of taking stuff from the White House and then obstructing investigators. Even the state case in Georgia, which again is about trying to overturn the election result there, if the Supreme Court had ruled that, then that really wouldn't be able to proceed at all. So a lot of his problems would evaporate. I think what we saw, though, today is an indication, even from some of those more conservative justices, that they're not really minded to agree with that idea of total immunity. What they might do is say, look, some things in this indictment against you, you should answer for. But that would introduce some new delays to the original trial process that's already been held up. And the probability of this getting to trial before November is increasingly unlikely. And of course, were Donald Trump to win in November, Valerie, and this case was still hanging over him, he could simply tell his Justice Department to drop it.
What does it mean, though, in terms of setting a precedent for not only Donald Trump, but also for future presidents?
Well, that's a key point here, because the Supreme Court's never been asked this question. Does a president have immunity from criminal prosecution? They've never been asked it because no previous president has been accused of criminal behaviour like this. So this is really brand new legal territory. And that's why I don't think they're going to come back with a judgment on this in any rush.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. In New York, Donald Trump was back in court, accused of falsifying business records stemming from hush money payments to the porn star Stormy Daniels during his campaign for the presidency back in 2016. Prosecutors allege the payments were part of a broader scheme to kill negative media stories about Mr. Trump. The tabloid publisher David Pecker was testifying again, as I heard from our New York correspondent Neda Tofik.
Under questioning by the prosecution, he really started to kind of outline more of this alleged catch and kill scheme where his tabloid, the National Enquirer, bought stories that were negative for Donald Trump's campaign and made sure that they never saw the light of day. And he says that happened with a former Playboy model, Karen McDougal. He says when he learned of her story, he told Donald Trump and Michael Cohen about it. They directed him to pay her $150,000. And they said, Michael Cohen, the boss will take care of it. He will pay you back for that. But David Pecker said when he spoke with his legal counsel at the National Enquirer, they did have legal concerns about him being reimbursed by Michael Cohen and Donald Trump, about it violating campaign finance laws. And ultimately, he told Michael Cohen, the deal's off, I don't want the money. So he was never reimbursed. And that kind of set the scene for when, right before the 2016 election, Stormy Daniels was shopping her story to outlets. David Pecker also alerted Donald Trump to that, he says, and Michael Cohen. And he says that he refused to buy her story, but told Michael Cohen that he should do it, that the boss, Donald Trump, would want him to.
And this was what a broader strategy to kill negative media stories about Donald Trump.
That's right. And what you have is the prosecution trying to paint that as a criminal conspiracy to influence the election, which violated election laws. And then they allege that Donald Trump falsified his corporate records to hide the true nature of those payments. What we heard the defense start to do in their questioning was poke holes in the prosecution's story. They asked David Pecker on the stand, you know, wasn't this standard operating procedure for you as a tabloid to purchase and suppress stories? And David Pecker said yes. And he said he had done that for the likes of Arnold Schwarzenegger, John F. Kennedy Jr., Tiger Woods, and even a well-known Democrat, Rahm Emanuel, Barack Obama's chief of staff.
Neda Tofik. It was a landmark case in 2020. The rape conviction in New York of the film producer Harvey Weinstein was hailed as a victory for the Me Too movement against sexual abuse and harassment, and he was sentenced to 23 years in prison. But now an appeals court in New York has overturned that judgment, saying Harvey Weinstein did not get a fair trial. At the time, dozens of women came forward to accuse the once powerful studio boss behind Oscar-winning films like Pulp Fiction and Shakespeare in Love. The New York Appeals Court said the judge involved in the trial had committed egregious errors by allowing accusers who were not part of the complaint to testify. Mr. Weinstein's lawyer, Arthur Adela, said the legal ruling was a great day for America.
The law was not applied fairly to Harvey Weinstein. And what the Court of Appeals, the highest court in the greatest state, in the greatest country, said today is that, yes, no one is above the law. But no one is below the law either.
Ashley Judd, an actor who says she was sexually harassed by Harvey Weinstein, responded to the new ruling.
This today is an act of institutional betrayal. And our institutions betray survivors of male sexual violence. And we need to work within and without the systems to start having what is known as institutional courage, to make sure that women and all people work in environments that are free from harassment and sexual violence.
The former film mogul remains in prison, having been separately convicted of rape in Los Angeles. Our correspondent, Nomi Iqbal, has this assessment of the ruling.
The Harvey Weinstein conviction in 2020 was almost the foundational case of the hashtag MeToo movement, one of the most important social movements in modern American history, where people spoke out against sexual violence and sexual assault. His conviction was seen as a huge moment, a huge victory for those women who had come forward in the trial. And for it now to have this stunning reversal is also seen as a moment of loss for many of them. We are getting reaction coming through. The lawyer representing Harvey Weinstein victims has called today's decision a major step back in holding those accountable for acts of sexual violence. Mr. Douglas Wigdall, the lawyer, goes on to say that courts routinely admit evidence of other uncharged acts where they assist juries in understanding issues concerning the intent. So almost they're rejecting the argument made by the majority of the judges at the Court of Appeals. It was a 4-3 decision. They essentially said he didn't get a fair trial. He still has the sentence to serve in California. It's up to the Manhattan District Attorney to now decide, is there going to be another trial? You do have many women who will now decide whether they want to give evidence again, whether this trial can even take place again. It's worth mentioning that at the time the trial was happening, there were these concerns being raised at the time, whether it was legally sound, whether it would result in a conviction, and if it did, would there be a reversal? So we don't know, as I say, exactly what the decision will be by the New York District Attorney.
Nomia Iqbal. The French President Emmanuel Macron has made an impassioned plea to European leaders, warning the EU faces an existential threat if it doesn't react to the changing world order. The President says Europe needs to increase its spending on defence and become more self-sufficient. Mr. Macron was speaking ahead of EU elections in June, in which his party is pulling well behind the far right. From Paris, our correspondent Hugh Schofield compiled this report.
Le risque est immense d'être fragilisé, voire relégué.
This was the French president ringing the alarm bell, raising themes he's raised before, but speaking now in a language clearly designed to leave his audience worried, even scared, about the changing state of the world and Europe's lack of preparedness for what lies ahead. Time and again, the president used the word naivety to describe the European mindset. He said that for too long, the EU had acted like an adolescent, looking for protection from others. But now it had to prove that it was grown up, because the world had suddenly become more dangerous.
Nous devons être lucides.
We must realize that our Europe today is mortal. It could die, and that depends entirely on our choices. But these choices must be made now.
Maintenant.
A paradigm shift in the state of Europe's world. Russia's open hostility, China's ruthless competition, America's disengagement. All this meant that Europe had to take massive decisions and start fighting for its own interests. It meant rearming. It meant, where necessary, economic protection for European industries and farmers. And it meant jolting European people out of their despondency and self-deprecation. President Macron's vision of the European predicament was unsettling, as he meant it to be.
Hugh Schofield. Researchers in India and the UK have found that a relatively new artificial sweetener has some worrying effects on cells and bacteria in the human gut. Called Neotame, it's related to the better-known aspartame, and it's been approved for use in more than 35 countries since 2010. The sweetener is most often used in cakes, soft drinks and chewing gum and is listed on ingredient labels as E961. The senior author of the study is Dr. Habibi Chitchka, an associate professor in biomedical sciences at Anglia Ruskin University here in the UK. She told Paul Henley more about the findings.
We did one set of experiments looking at human gut cells that we grow in the lab, and we saw that Neotame can cause damage to those cells at very high concentrations that might be a little higher than you or I would normally see. We did find that the Neotame caused the cells to just die, which was very worrying. But at lower concentrations, there was also some gut damage. So it can cause a breakdown in the barrier that those cells form, which means we might get more movement of bacteria from our gut into our blood. And that can be linked to things like inflammation or irritable bowel syndrome. And we looked at the effect of Neotame on two types of bacteria that are found in our gut microbiota. And we saw, quite worryingly, the bacteria became more resistant to antibiotics, and it started to actually invade the human gut cells. So the bacteria became more invasive and more damaging. So we almost get a sort of double hit from the Neotame treatment.
And is it reasonable to suppose that this would happen inside the human body as opposed to in petri dishes?
There is a good link with the human gut cells that might have an effect in humans. And actually, we do know from some clinical studies that artificial sweeteners can have a negative effect, particularly for people who have diseases like irritable bowel syndrome. Not specifically with Neotame, but with other sweeteners, they tend to be less responsive to their different medications that they take.
Some people really do need to avoid sugar. Is Neotame any better or worse than other artificial sweeteners, do you know?
From our own studies and what's in the literature, there doesn't seem to be any difference between Neotame and other sweeteners. But it is worth noting that Neotame is newer and there are far fewer studies that have been done on it.
Is it fair to say that you don't know if any artificial sweetener is completely safe in comparison to sugar, for example?
It's a really good question. So we don't know that yet. There are some early indications that some of the natural sweeteners, so things like stevia or monk fruit, could potentially be less damaging. But there really, again, is not enough research on the topic yet.
Dr. Havavi Chishka. Next to a world premiere, an opera in Arabic performed in Saudi Arabia. It's the first time Saudi Arabia has produced a grand opera, as I heard from our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
Singing is as you would hear in a Western opera, but it's with an Arabic libretto written by a Saudi poet. And the composer, who's Australian, Lee Bradshaw, was telling me that the brief to him was to produce a Western opera, but with the influence of Arab and specifically Saudi music. So he listened to lots of music in Saudi Arabia. He found it difficult, though, because there's so many different traditions there, so many different tribes, that in the end, his real way into it was the text itself, the actual rhythm of the Arabic poetry that gave him the vocal lines.
So it was commissioned by somebody in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, it's part of a culture ministry. They're building an amazing state-of-the-art opera house in Diriyah, which is the old part of Riyadh, which is being developed massively. It's part of Saudi Arabia's push to establish itself as a cultural giant, particularly, obviously, in the Gulf region. And this is starting from really nowhere.
So what is it about? Is it very much a Saudi Arabian theme?
It is. And what's interesting, too, that it's a Saudi Arabian theme, but again, maybe 5 to 10 years ago, you wouldn't have done this. It's a pre-Islamic story of a woman who had the gift of prophecy, but like Cassandra in Greek legend, was never believed. So she tells her tribespeople that there's danger coming and they don't listen and it all ends tragically.
And the main role is played by a British singer.
Yes, Dame Sarah Connolly. She was telling me that she had sleepless nights about singing in Arabic, the sounds that she was making. And she said this slightly shamefaced, but she said this helped her, that one of the sounds, a very specific Arabic sound, very guttural, that she thought of Kermit the Frog in The Muppets, and that helped her to do it. They do have a Saudi Arabian opera singer in it, and they do have Saudi performers. I don't know specifically why they didn't give the main role to Saudi opera singer. This is very much an evolving art form in Saudi Arabia, so it's very limited in the number of people who would be able to do it. I mean, interestingly, Lee Bradshaw, when I asked him why he did this, there are issues obviously over performing sport, culture, entertainment in Saudi Arabia, human rights, etc. And what he said was that the hundreds of Saudis who came to audition as acrobats, as musicians, as dancers, that the way that they told him that they never thought in their lives they'd be able to do something like that in Saudi Arabia, that was something that really, really struck him.
Sebastian Usher. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
We both are always on the street or on the tube. So I'm always surprised if someone says, can I get a selfie, Neil? I've sort of forgotten I'm me. I wish I lived my
life free and easier. The return of the multi-million record-selling duo, the Pet Shop Boys. The transitional council set up to take over power in Haiti and organise elections has been sworn in. The body is also tasked with the unenviable job of restoring order to Haiti, which is suffering from a wave of deadly gang violence that's killed thousands and caused many to flee the capital, Port-au-Prince. In a speech during the ceremony, the new interim Prime Minister, Michel Patrick Boisvert, said it was an important moment.
Haiti, our country, is at a crossroads in the search for solutions to overcome this multidimensional political crisis, the consequences of which are detrimental to the population, to property, and both public and private infrastructure.
Our correspondent in the region, Will Grant, told me more about Thursday's developments, starting with the swearing-in ceremony, which didn't go quite according to plan.
With more than 80% of the capital, Port-au-Prince, in hands of the gangs, there was gunfire and violence near the National Palace where it was due to take place, forcing a last-minute change to the Prime Minister's office. It does, on paper at least, and in practice, of course, move things on. But, of course, there's no sense, I think, in which Haiti is pulled out of its political malaise.
And what do you think the council's first actions will be regarding the powerful gangs in Haiti? I mean, how can they tackle them?
That's really the issue, isn't it? Because until you tackle the gangs, you can't really begin to bring any sense of normality to the streets and get the aid in that's so desperately needed. The airport remains closed after all these weeks and months, which I think is one of the gangs' key bargaining chips, to be honest, that they can keep this airport closed, force it closed through violence, and refuse to back down. So I think whether or not it's through engagement or through concerted conflict, they do need to reach some kind of situation with the gangs in order for aid to start coming in.
Do you think they'll need the help of, say, an armed international peacekeeping force?
Well, certainly that's the vision of the US State Department, of the other member states, of CARICOM, that this would have the backing of a police force, international police force, primarily led by Kenyan officers. That doesn't seem to be getting off the ground for the time being. Again, it's been weeks and months in the pipeline without actually coming to fruition. Of course, certain stability was needed at the top, and I think the hope is within the Transitional Council that that will now allow for certain security steps to be taken. But of course, you speak to people on the streets of Haiti, as I did earlier this year, and they don't really have any sense of optimism about this Transitional Council being able to effect any meaningful change, at least in the short term.
And how desperate is the situation there now?
I mean, it's horrific. You just need to look at the language being used by the international bodies on the ground. Catastrophic, cataclysmic. It is that bad. You've got 100,000 people who've moved to the safer cities. You've got extreme malnutrition, particularly among the youngest. So, yeah, it's a dire situation and one that's not getting better quickly.
Will Grant. The World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, has ordered an independent review into its handling of a doping case against Chinese swimmers. More from our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
Last week, WADA and the Chinese anti-doping authorities confirmed a story dating back to 2021 that was unveiled in investigative reports, admitting that 23 of China's top swimmers were secretly allowed to continue competing after testing positive for a performance-enhancing drug. WADA says at the time it accepted Beijing's explanation that the swimmers had unwittingly ingested the drug at a swim meet. Several of the swimmers won medals at the Tokyo Olympics that year, including golds. Following intense global criticism, a Swiss prosecutor, Eric Cotier, will lead the investigation into the incident and will be asked to submit findings within 2 months, before some of the same Chinese swimmers are set to compete at the Paris Games. WADA says it will also send a compliance audit team to China to assess its anti-doping program.
Celia Hatton. The city of Dubai in the United Arab Emirates is synonymous with scorching heat and the desert. But last week it made headlines when exceptionally heavy rains caused major floods that killed several people, caused widespread disruption and left many thousands of passengers stranded in the main airport. Now a group of climate scientists has said the rainfall was most likely made worse by man-made climate change. Our climate editor, Justin Rowlett, has been looking at the study by the World Weather Attribution Initiative.
Year and a half of rain in 24 hours in a city that very rarely sees any rain at all. I mean, it will go months without a drop of rain. So the infrastructure to channel that water away from essential infrastructure, from homes, just isn't there. And that's why we saw those incredible pictures of flooding. The floods poured into the buildings, damaged infrastructure. There are some amazing pictures, for example, of the airport where the runway was covered in water and you could see jet planes blowing great clouds of water up as they tried to manoeuvre around the airport. So this study that we got published today says that analysing the data, they find the storm was made between 10 and 40% more intense because of climate change. Now, that is a huge range and reflects a deep and profound underlying uncertainty because, again, these rainstorms are so rare. They don't have lots of data to compare how big storms are because big storms don't happen very often. But what they are saying is the underlying trend of the warming globe increasing the intensity of rainstorms. They say that underlying trend is very clear. I mean, it shows that our world is changing in a really profound way. We're in we had 10 months that were the record, the hottest months ever recorded for that time of year. And that shows us the hottest year ever last year. The sea temperatures around the world are the hottest they've ever been at the moment. And all of this should be profoundly worrying for us because it signifies the degree to which our world is changing.
Justin Rollat. Police in Europe have arrested 9 citizens from Georgia after a series of raids across Europe aimed at combating the theft of rare books and their replacement with fakes. It's thought that over the last couple of years, thieves posing as researchers have examined and even photographed books held in national libraries, returning weeks later to replace them with almost perfect replicas. The French international news agency AFP's Magda Padchokrek has been closely covering the story, and Sean Lay asked her just how the thieves pulled off what is now being called the Pushkin plot.
The thieves were using fake identities to pose as researchers and get access to priceless Russian 19th century books by such standout names as Alexander Pushkin or Nikolai Gogol. They borrowed the books and then pretended to work and study them and replaced them with copies.
So when you say they pretended to study them, they were actually doing what?
They were reading them, but the library suspected when they were not on camera, like they were also taking pictures of the books, basically.
And in one case, I understand that the library itself didn't even know that the book on their shelf was a fake until it was pointed out to them.
Actually, it took quite a long time for the library in Warsaw to realise some of the books had been replaced by fakes because some of them prepared by the thieves were so meticulously prepared. The librarians and the experts had difficulties finding out that these were actually fakes.
So it's all a bit embarrassing for the libraries involved. But I mean, it is quite an audacious crime, isn't it? I mean, they seem to have been pretty kind of shameless about it.
Yes, indeed. They were, but they were also well prepared from what I gathered from the experts. They knew where to sit in the reading room to not be caught by the video surveillance. They knew how to leave the cover intact and replace what's inside the book.
And you yourself played a bit of a part in helping the authorities sort of join the dots to realise that this wasn't just a problem in one university in one country.
That's true. 'Cause when we first saw the somewhat dry press release by the University of Warsaw saying that they discovered a theft of valuable objects, of valuable books, we started searching for similar cases. And then it turned out that Estonia had already seen something similar. Then we saw that Latvia had also had something similar. And while we were investigating, the news broke that a Lithuanian university in Vilnius also discovered a theft of actually the same titles by the same authors. Connecting and linking the dots was not that difficult. It was pretty clear from the very beginning that these must be the same people who were responsible.
Where have the books ended up and how did you discover that they were actually being sold at auction?
I spoke to an expert at the University of Warsaw, who's a Russia expert, and he showed me screen grabs of the auctions organized by an auction house in Russia. And the auction house did not care that much to even blur the traces of the books coming from Warsaw, because the pictures that they had on the website, they had stamps coming from the University of Warsaw's library. This was easily traceable back to Warsaw.
Magda Patchokrek, AFP's Central Europe reporter. And finally, the Pet Shop Boys, one of the most influential bands to emerge from the 1980s pop scene, are back. The English duo, Chris Lowe and Neil Tennant's latest album, Nonetheless, marks a return to the lush symphonic sound of what lead singer Tennant once called their imperial phase. And it finds them addressing everything from societal change to the inner thoughts of Donald Trump's security detail. Our music correspondent, Mark Savage, has been speaking to Chris and Neil.
It's 40 years since the Pet Shop Boys released their debut single, West End Girls. 50 million record sales later, Neil Tennant and Chris Lowe had to find a new way of working for their 15th album, Nonetheless, which was written in the middle of lockdown.
The weather was great. I mean, I know it wasn't like this if you were living in a block of flats in Birmingham, but I was in the countryside in Kent. Chris kept sending music through, I kept sending lyrics through to him.
I remember wondering.
Sun was shining. I felt quite euphoric about it, really.
Who am I? And what will I turn to be?
New London Boy, on the record, is kind of about your arrival in London in the 1970s.
And you are no boy.
I moved down properly at the beginning of 1973, in the height of the glam rock period, and me and two friends from Newcastle shared a flat in Tottenham. Newcastle was terrifying in the early 70s because the skinheads. Any time I've ever been punched in my life, actually, by skinheads, waiting for a bus in Newcastle once. So I was always a bit paranoid because of that. And I probably brought that paranoia down to London with me.
Skinheads will mock you, call you a fag.
London was a bit scary at night, but we used to get all dressed up in our glam rock finery and go out. I had a job in the summer of 1973 in an insurance company on the King's Road, but with white Oxford bags and a white tank top. And I used to wear these women's shoes with big platform heels. And gay men used to make comments as I walked down the road.
Did you used to get whistled as well?
Yeah, precisely, yeah.
And that's how you went to work in the insurance brokers?
Yeah, the guy that I worked for was very gay.
Chris, while Neil's doing all of that, well, you were studying architecture. Did anything you designed ever get built?
Well, it's not much to boast about, but I did spend a lot of time working on a staircase, which did get built in Milton Keynes in an industrial unit.
Another new song finds Neil Tennant imagining himself in the shoes of one of Donald Trump's bodyguards.
I read that President Trump's official guards didn't respect him because of his attitude, I think, to the FBI and the CIA. He dissed very early into his presidency. They held him in very low esteem. And yet, of course, they've got to protect him. They've got to take a bullet from him in extreme circumstance.
I wonder if he's realised that right behind him he's despised.
Do you ever see yourself retiring?
It's not on the agenda, per se, but who knows.
The touring bit, though, I guess a bit much, doesn't it?
Could do.
It was hard work going around Latin America just before Christmas.
It was fun, though. I totally remember.
Well, you see, you're remembering it differently than you remembered it.
Rose-tinted spectacles.
Yeah.
The concerts were
great. I mean, it was great, the whole thing, but it's tiring.
Like silent movie stars in 60s Hollywood. No one knows who you are in the hipster neighbourhood.
When you go out, do you get recognised?
Sometimes. We have a very acceptable level of fame. We both are always on the street or on the tube. So I'm always surprised if someone says, oh, can I get a selfie, Neil? I've sort of forgotten I'm me.
I wish I lived my life free and easier. I need to find a new bohemia.
Neil Tennant ending that report by Mark Savage. And the new album, Nonetheless, is released on the 26th of April. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Till next time. Bye-bye.
This week on Witness History, we're bringing you five incredible stories from South Africa. You'll hear about the heartbreaking life of Sarah Bartman, an indigenous South African woman who was taken to Europe to perform in 19th century freak shows. Plus, how a South African singer called Brenda Fassie became known as the Madonna of the townships, and the school children who marched against apartheid. That's Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts.